Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vago Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. And joining us now for one of our conversations with leading strategists and thinkers is Dr. Corey Shockey, who leads the defense and foreign policy practice at the American Enterprise Institute. She's one of the nation's leading thinkers on strategy as well as the civil-military divide. This conversation is sponsored by General Atomics Aeronautical Systems and is devoted to the memory of one of the nation's greatest national security strategists, Andy Marshall, the former director of the Pentagon's Office of Net Assessment. And before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage, and Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Corey, thanks so very much for joining us.
It's a great pleasure.
You and I have been talking civil-military relations for a very long time. It has been a focus of your career as well, as somebody who has devoted her life to national security as you have. And the discussion all too often tends to boil down to, you know, whether Jim Mattis or Lloyd Austin as retired four-stars should serve as defense secretary, rather than plumbing some of the deeper issues of the civil-military divide. And that was accentuated. You know, you joined us after Lafayette Park, you joined us again after January 6th. You know, for some, it's a concern of over-militarization of foreign and defense policy over the past couple of decades, an excessive deference to uniformed leaders. For others, it's an unhealthy national decision to rely on an ever smaller group of Americans for uniformed service, right? Whether they're, you know, more highly compensated, but it's a very small number that is willing and able to serve at the end of the day. And one of the things that Tom Ricks, who was a guest on this forum a couple of weeks ago, has noted, right, a healthy civil-military relationship is vital to generating good strategy and avoiding misunderstanding at a time like this, where muddled thinking is a problem. Why is, from your standpoint, a healthy civil-military balance of worldviews important, and what's currently wrong with where we are?
So I want to start with the second question, which is, I don't think there's anything fundamentally wrong with where we are. I think civil-military relations in the United States are healthy, vibrant, and in a really good place. So my qualifications are on the margins. I do think the norm against a recently retired military officer being the Secretary of Defense has been abolished by infrequent succession. Overwhelming congressional confirmation of two recently retired general officers. As the Reagan Institute's recent poll of public attitudes makes clear, American admiration for the military has dropped more than 14 points in the last year, which is a big diminution. I think it's probably temporary. And if I were betting my mortgage payment, I would think it's the result of the military's visible involvement in policing social justice protests last summer. In particular, the image of General Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, in combat fatigues, walking through Lafayette Square, which had recently been forcibly cleared of peaceful protesters. I think it's a near-term hit to admiration because the American public's really uncomfortable with our military in domestic political roles, and they always have been. So I think that civil-military relations are in a positive, healthy space, but there is this dip in support. And I think it will attenuate and we'll see the bounce back to levels in the 70s of public admiration and support for the American military. Once people really kind of pause and think about and internalize how important the correction that General Milley and other military leaders made after the July 9th incidents in which General Milley did an outstanding job, and other military leaders also, General McConville, around the time of the election, emphasizing that the American military has no role in elections in the United States, despite what a prominent veteran, Michael Flynn, was arguing for military supervision of rerunning elections. So I think, you know, what we are seeing is a dent in popularity of the military because of the very visible involvement of prominent veterans at a pretty sharp-edged and difficult time in American political life. And the institution of the military, the active duty military and its leaders, working to recenter the force in its oath and in its fealty to the Constitution and better shield it from political uses by politicians.
Let me push on that just a little bit, though, right? I mean, the poll indicates a drop that it goes back to 2018. And it may have been accentuated, right? I mean, it was down in a lot of categories, including among military members and their families as well, right? I mean, which was a little bit surprising, as Jamie McIntyre of The Examiner put it. Do you think, though, that there are broader disconnects that are going on? I mean, for example, there is a deference that's general, right? I mean, there are some even within, there are even retired military friends of mine who worry whether that civil military balance is not as balanced in favor of civilians as it should be, that that there is a little bit of deference, and that, right? I mean, I just want to get your sense on that. And what are the impediments to improving the relationship at the end of the day?
So I think that's true. And I think actually the appointment of Jim Mattis and then the appointment of Lloyd Austin are the proof of that case, right? That we value military judgment and experience to a greater degree than we value civilian judgment and experience in the defense enterprise.
Right.
And in my judgment, probably wrongly. So for example, President Biden set listed as the first reason he was nominating Lloyd Austin to be the Secretary of Defense was because vaccinations were going to be a huge logistical challenge. And therefore, the military needed to be at the center of it, which, first of all, was not consistent with President Biden's actual vaccine rollout plan. But second of all, the American military is not the only part of our society that knows anything about logistics, right? Hire Jeff Bezos if you think logistics are the most important thing that the American military can contribute.
And even when the U.S. military did get involved, right? I mean, the Army Materiel Command, for all of its admirable qualities, fouled up twice. Right, that forced
Excellent
General Perna
point.
to apologize. Right.
Excellent point. I do think we are overdue for a slight rebalancing and an appreciation that there are a lot of people in the Pentagon who can contribute the judgment that Jim Mattis or Lloyd Austin would bring to policy decisions. But there are not a lot of people in the Pentagon who could contribute what founders of Google could contribute, or a woman who runs a VC-founded billion-dollar startup, or somebody who's worked on social justice issues their whole life, or somebody who's been a prisoner of war, right? What I know about being part of and leading teams is that diversity produces better outcomes. And the Harvard Business Review has actually published a lot of recent research in support of that notion. The returns to funds that have more diverse leadership, all sorts of those kinds of metrics show that diversity gives you lots of different turns of the kaleidoscope. And that's really important in creative undertakings.
Do you think, though, right, but I mean, diversity, depending on how you look at it, is under assault, right? I mean, we heard from Representative Jim Banks, the chairman of the Republican Study Group, right? A very prominent conservative organization up on the Hill, blasting the chief of naval operations for a book that was on the CNO's reading list about white privilege. You know, said it was egregious, said the CNO is damaging the Navy. I should point out, I believe Congressman Banks is a reserve, United States Navy reserve lieutenant commander. I mean, at the end of the day, we've heard a conservative commentator, Tucker Carlson, assailing pregnant women in the military. I don't know where to take that because I have so many female military friends of mine, most of whom have had children in the course of their military service and managed to get right back on the job. Many of them stay on the job until they deliver. More broadly speaking, Corey. There is this, you know, as you said, there is this tendency of looking at military advice as superior. And even among military people, there is occasionally like, oh, you know, we got to listen to the civilian weenies, right? As if the weenies don't have a lot to contribute. And then, of course, it goes the other way, right? Where there are some civilians who do have a chip on their shoulder and think that military people are not as smart as they are. I understand that. That's part of, I guess, maybe a historic push and pull. But, right, there are some latent frustrations about diversity, right? They're right under the surface. It goes to the heart of the concern that people have about racism and extremism in the ranks, as we saw it raise its ugly head on January the 6th. How do we get to the heart of...
It's not clear it raised its ugly head on January 6th. I'll come back to that, but
okay.
Let me make a couple of more general comments first.
Sure.
That, yes, I do think the military considering itself different and better and the rest of American society is a danger. It's always a danger. But I don't think it is particularly salient right now. I actually think the last 7 months or so have been a beautiful tribute by the American military to the Constitution and to their fealty to the Constitution and what makes the American military so special is that relationship. I'm not worried about loud, angry arguments over political correctness in the military because I actually think ignoring those things is a bigger problem than arguing about them. And our military is our society. And so of course you have those kinds of tensions in the ranks and amongst the leadership because we're arguing our way through it as a broader political community. And so it would be really weird if you didn't also have those kinds of tensions and those kinds of arguments about how they're affecting our military forces. Banks's comments, I would just say that I think wide reading is a pretty good preparation for all sorts of things in this life, including warfare. And understanding what we might look like to some parts of our society or to other societies is enriching. You don't have to agree with everything you read. You can learn from lots of stuff you disagree with. And on the Tucker Carlson business, it seemed to me like, you know, the last gasp of faux masculinity, right? The notion that, you know, everyone in the American military has to be able to carry artillery shells at any moment in time, and that we can't possibly find ways to benefit from the 50% of our population who have something to contribute and who have volunteered to contribute it on all of our behalf. And so I've actually thought it was delicious to see Carlson try and be a tough guy, and then watch all of the magnificent examples, you know, of the service Twitter feeds celebrating the women soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines who are part of our fighting force. I actually thought, in a weird way, just as I think Mike Flynn is good for civil military relations in the United States, because it's reminding people that you can be a reckless idiot and still prove good at the narrow things you were doing in the military. I think Tucker Carlson creating this fracas produced a wonderful opportunity for the military across all ranks to remind us all how important their sisters in the ranks are. I think it's actually turned out to the net benefit of our broader society understanding our military and understanding the important role female soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines have in our military.
I would second and triple that absolutely in terms of the contributions and that they're happening every day. And God willing, we get to a point where it becomes completely invisible over time. Unfortunately, that's going to be a little bit while before we get to that point. Yeah. Unfortunately.
So I worked in the joint staff in General Powell's tenure in the early 1990s. And I do remember him once wistfully saying to me that he yearned for the day where he would be remembered as the youngest chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff.
And a very, very apt point, by the way, right? I mean, ultimately, we ascribe color and sex and first to all of this stuff that should be completely invisible. Sadly, neither racism nor sexism has been stamped out, which becomes then a complication to the broader relationship. So I want to go to January 6th for a moment. So you're somewhat more relaxed, but there are those, including those in uniform, who look with concern, given that, you know, the active duty force, right? I mean, active in reserve is about 1%. And if you add retirees and everybody else to it, I believe it gets to like 7% or something like that. And at the end of the day, those who were arrested constituted, I've lost count, but it was a little bit north of 20%, which then suggests to people, well, wait a minute, there could be a disconnect among those who are serving or have served. And why are they attracted perhaps to racist and extremist ideology? Secretary Austin has launched stand downs. Friends of mine who are in uniform are going through some of that refresher training and reminding, right? Because the military has hewn to the notion of, I can't change how you think, but I can punish how you behave. It's just that some of these folks who harbor these ideologies don't necessarily act on them. From your standpoint, why is this lesser of a problem than some other people think it is?
So I think it's important not to conflate people who are serving in the military with veterans, right? Because veterans, there's another term for America's military veterans, and it's citizens. And so the fact that somebody, you know, did a tour in the Vietnam era and participated in the insurrection, is that the most important determinant of either why they did it or what we should be afraid of driving this? I think we don't know enough to be able to make those kinds of judgments. And I have actually been a little bit disturbed by how quick journalists have been to jump to the conclusion that this is a military or paramilitary problem. The people in military service, active duty or guard and reserve involved in January 6th are a very tiny number. It's something like 3 or 4.
Right.
And the FBI has now made a few hundred arrests. So the honest answer is we don't know whether we have a problem with violent extremism in our military. Anybody who has any data on that, I would love to see it, but I haven't been able to find it. And the Anti-Defamation League hasn't been able to find it.
Right.
And it looks to me, looking through the people who have been arrested after the January 6th insurrection, most of them were bounced out of military service. And that could actually tell us that the military screening systems work pretty well, that these people are veterans and not in active duty military service. I think we don't know enough to be able to answer that question yet. And I asked several friends who are military veterans their unscientific sense of how deep a problem this was. And it was fascinating to me that they all gave the same answer, which is that they didn't know that the military tried to screen for those attitudes at admission to the ranks, but that the people who would know are the lieutenants. And that, I think, is why the stand down is a useful exercise, because it's in small unit leadership and participation that we're going to learn the answer to that question, not what senior officers see in the headquarters. So I think we don't actually know the answer about whether we have a serious problem. I do think veterans are citizens, so we shouldn't be surprised. And we especially shouldn't be surprised, since it looks like violent right-wing groups are actively recruiting veterans in order to try and normalize their terrible ideology. So they are trying, just as elected politicians try to hide behind uniforms for to draw on the positive, the approval and admiration the American public has for the military. Right-wing violent groups are trying to do that as well. And so that's something we need to think about. How do we handle it? How do we make sure that we rebuild the sense of community in all of our communities that foster other kinds of belonging, I think, is the solution to that. I don't think we should expect the American military to solve the problems of veterans for us.
It's interesting you raise that, right? I mean, because, for example, when it comes to veteran suicides, there is a legitimate question to ask whether this was a suicide problem that, right, somebody didn't have a sense of belonging, they joined the military, they had that sense of belonging, and then when they were no longer in the military or that camaraderie of combat was over, did some of those underlying issues come back, right? I mean, so is this necessarily a military problem, or is this a broader societal problem that a group that is yearning for that belonging, right? I mean, it's an interesting question,
yeah,
and I'm not
and
sure
I think we don't know the answer to that.
We don't know the answer to that. Let me take you to a question, though, which I do believe gets to the heart of the concern. We had Admiral Mullen on recently, and, you know, this was an issue that he had been tracking and looking at, right? Not necessarily one that he's answered, but his question always was, look, I mean, we have 1% of the nation that's serving and 99% that's not, right? And it's only a matter of time before those two disconnect from one another, right? That the military sees itself as superior to society because it's serving, and then a civilian world that actually doesn't want to serve and is happy to put even more compensation on those who are willing to do it because they're not willing to do it. Okay, that's not healthy, because you want there to be sort of a sense of service on both sides of that equation at the end of the day. How do we address this, right? Because Secretary Austin, in his first message to the force, struck on a lot of important chords, right? We're going to tackle the pandemic, which is really important. China is going to be a focus. Cyber is really important. But then he also said, hey, we're going to try to improve benefits for military members. And there are friends of mine who are military members who say, look, I mean, we already have a lot of benefits. In fact, military friends of mine are like, hey, we're willing to trade off some benefits to make sure that we keep the numbers, right? But our philosophy has always been increase the compensation and further shrink the force. How do we get to the heart of this disconnect? Because the drop in popularity right? People were willing to pay that much when people were doing multiple combat deployments. But now there are people who look at this and say, hey, you know, that's quite a lot of compensation, guys, when, you know, you're not really being shot at anymore. How do we get this balance right?
And when civilians aren't seeing the same kind of elevation of their compensation.
Correct.
Right?
Right. I mean, so much so that military people can't afford to go into civilian jobs because their compensation actually in uniform is superior to the compensation they might get in civilian life, especially if you're, for example, an Army mechanic or a Navy machinist, for example.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I agree with Admiral Mullen that we should always keep a carefully attuned eye to the divergence between our civilian society and our military. But I would point out a couple of things. And there are lots of different useful ways to handle it. But let me point out a couple of things. The fact that 1% of American, actually 0.5% of Americans serve in our military isn't because American civilians won't serve in the military. It's because our defense establishment has determined that we only need a military of that size. So, you know, it's lazy to suggest that, you know, these civilians, they just won't do it. And our military is uniquely different and noble. Our military has determined the size of the force and therefore who serves. Our military has also, so I got up on my high horse yesterday when I was talking to some of the Army's major generals. And one of them pointed out that, you know, America's going to the dogs because 71% of Americans can't meet the standards for admission to the military, as though that were the law of gravity. And I pointed out, you could set a different standard. You could set a standard that 98% of America could, right? Like, you're a participant in this, not, you know, it's not an act of God or the law of gravity. So I don't think we should let the military act superior because of the 1%. And I don't think we should let them act superior because of this 71% can't meet, right? The American Army that won World War II didn't have the standards of admission that the American Army does now. And they did all right. So we need to acknowledge that these are social constructs and that the military is a participant in the construction. The second thing I would say, though, is that that there are a whole bunch of ways to weave our military and our society more closely together. My personal favorite is I would love to see us start a national program that recruits women and men leaving military service to be school teachers, right? Because America's children need great role models. And the men and women of the American military, by public affirmation, are terrific role models. I'd love to see them in classrooms. You could also eliminate commissaries. You could eliminate chapels on military bases so that people went to church with their co-religionists in the broader community. You could, right? Like, there are all sorts of things you could do that we just haven't done yet. And the reason we haven't done it is because we don't actually think this is a very serious problem. And we do want the comfort and convenience for our military of some of the ways in which they are separate from us, like having chaplains who understand what families separated by deployments are going through.
I think that's an excellent point, by the way. Right. Let me take you to the diversity question, right? I was born and raised in New York City on the Upper West Side of Manhattan at a time when New York was actually kind of a military state, and New York City was home. Governor's Island was home to the United States Coast Guard. It was one of the largest bases the Coast Guard had on the East Coast. There was Brooklyn Navy Yard. There were major naval shipyards on the other side of the Hudson River. You were from California, which was another very big military state. I mean, I think people have a tendency of thinking of San Francisco, sort of Haight-Ashbury and hippies and all that stuff, you know, and Palo Alto and Berkeley and all this stuff. Whereas actually, San Francisco was a serious Navy and military town, whether it was from Fort Ord or Treasure Island or Alameda. That, you know, but then we went to the Southern Smile, right? I mean, super basing in southern states, winnowing down that presence in the North Philadelphia, another big Navy town, and Philadelphia
and also Naval Yard. Ceasing to recruit in populations that were less target rich than the ones that we draw the majority of our force for. So you raise a fabulous point, Vago, which is that these are choices, and they may be choices made for very good reasons, but Rosa Brooks covers this in her chapter in Jim's and my book, Warriors and Citizens. We're making choices about where we recruit, right? So Stanford has an ROTC program, but in name only. You have to actually go over to Berkeley to do your ROTC, because the military has made a choice not to squander resources on a campus like Stanford, which, because there are only 6,000 students, is going to have a very small ROTC presence. But a much larger campus like Berkeley, which in which you will have more. It's the trade-off of, do you want efficiency or do you want to optimize to some other criteria of outcome?
Let me ask you very briefly, right? We're talking about the fact that both of us are from places that actually ended up losing a lot of military capability. Do you think, and I should say full disclosure for our audience, you're on the panel who's looking at renaming and whether military bases, the commission to rename military bases, now named for Confederate leaders at the end of the day. Do we need further rounds of base closures, Corey? Or do you actually think that you think we do? Don't you think that exacerbates the problem of separating America from its military if we further keep further consolidating?
Not really, because American military bases have become so closed off from their communities that I'm not sure that the presence of a military installation brings all of the benefits that are implicit in your statement. But the second thing is, most of the facilities, the last time I checked, the Pentagon thought that we had nearly 30% excess facilities. And that doesn't mean close Fort Hood or close the Camp Pendleton, but it does mean we are keeping a lot of facilities open that we don't use and shouldn't be paying for, so that we can move that money to higher priority needs in the force. So yeah, we absolutely should close more bases, but maybe we need to build some in places that they aren't too.
I should give a little bit of credit to General Odierno, who's from New Jersey, and was one of those folks, I think Barney Dempsey also recognized, right? The importance of actually trying to get in and compete in Boston, compete in New York, and in major metropolitan cities, because, you know, if you're concerned that your military is skewing too conservative, you may want to actually recruit from places in the country that could offset that a little bit. And then everybody benefits from those interactions at the end of the day. You said that the constraints are artificial, right? And I love your example of World War II. Do we need other forms of service as well, Corey, to, you know, whether it's direct commissions? We've got Jim McConville, who's been talking about that. The British and foreign militaries do a terrific job of that. They look at a Corey Shockey and say, hey, wouldn't it be great? You know, she's do not promote and maybe do not deploy, but she can mentor. There's all sorts of stuff she can do. Let's bring her in as a colonel. I know that other militaries do this and do it very effectively. I think that Chief McConville is on the absolute right track in trying to do that. It creates butthurt among those people who made colonel over 26 years as opposed to overnight. But do we need to have programs like that? Do we need to make reserve service easier and more flexible at the end of the day? What are the things that we can do to try to bridge this gap? Because my concern is, you know, in the event of a national crisis, and this is something Admiral Mullen discussed, his concern was get that discussion at the dinner table now, so that, God forbid, in a national mobilization crisis a couple of years from now, is not the first time people are confronting the reality, holy crap, we have to bring the draft back and expand the military, right? To get this sense that everybody's got a little skin in this game. Do we need to do something broader from your standpoint?
Well, I'm not sure. I don't know the answer to that. So I love the idea of voluntary national service. I love these youngsters who teach for America, who, and I believe that the pandemic response bill that President Biden signed a day or two ago actually has a provision for a national service program, which would be fabulous. And it would also go some way towards bridging this gap, you know, because one way to do it, one of my favorite military family members, whenever they are thanked for their service, turns around and says, thanks for being worth defending. There are lots of ways to reach across the gap, right? To celebrate school teachers and firefighters and cops and people who stock grocery store shelves. You know, the military aren't the only admirable people in American society. And so there are lots of ways to make that shift. Direct commissionings might be one way. I mean, I'd love to see Eric Schmidt in uniform and spending all of his time working, how do we force technology into our weapon systems and our practices where we need it? And I could think of lots of people who could make important contributions if we had a broader sense of how do we contribute to the defense effort. But I don't know that we need it. We may need it someday, but I actually think if service isn't voluntary, you get all of the problems of discipline and shirking that I wouldn't want to bring back into a military that is a lot less reliant on numbers and a lot more reliant on talent and initiative.
I loved your point. I loved your last point, by the way, but I also particularly liked your point that when people complain about this stuff, right, it's not a law of gravity. All of this stuff is actually invented. We invented it, right? Everything from what we have to really worry about the debt. And if you look at it galactically, why would you worry about it, right? It's a synthetic construct. Oh yeah, that's right. We've made it important. Whatever we've made important, we can make unimportant, right? And we can drive some of these changes. So you could actually listen more to an Eric Schmidt, for example, to redo your processes and accelerate things, right? The development of any system does not have to take 15 years. We showed in World War II that we could develop very big systems. Oh, I don't know, like a Horizon 3 atom bomb in 3 years, right? It just took some dedication.
My AEI colleague, Bill Greenwald, has a terrific report out on how to change our programming, budgeting, and procurement processes to solve a lot of the problems that exist on the kinds of things you're exactly talking about.
And we were lucky to have him on 2 weeks ago almost to talk to us about the report
fabulous.
That Dan Patt from the Hudson Institute also participated in. Look, I mean, I think it's fantastic. I mean, you know, I've written many times over the years about the speed with which we were able to do some really enormous things. And I commend people to check the report out because ultimately it is an extremely important work because they talk about the mechanics in order to drive that. But let me get you focused on this question as our time draws a little shorter than I'd like. One of the things that we like telling ourselves, and I think that everybody who is in uniform is grappling with this, right? I mean, the American sense of self is we're the best. The men and women who are serving are the best. And there is tremendous eye-watering talent across the United States military. And for those who talk about extremism, the overwhelming majority are patriotic Americans who are doing their duty, and they have no chip on their shoulder about whether they're better or not than anybody else in society. So I have to stress that. But the question is whether this force that we look at and say is the most combat experienced force actually has the right experience level for the challenge that we face ahead. And Tom Ricks, to bring Tom back into the conversation, likes to point out that, well, the British military actually, when World War I started, was the most experienced in the world. It was just very experienced at small wars. It was not experienced at big wars. And things ended up not going particularly well. And you can even look at that in World War II, in American forces, some of the more experienced officers were too timid. You know, it took to sweep aside some of the older deadwood to get a more innovative generation of new officers going. Do we have the right experience base from your standpoint for the challenge that we face with China?
That's a fabulous question. So I think that if I were an adversary of the United States, I would work hard to develop a strategy that prevented time for adaptation, right? Because the great genius of American society is incremental improvement, building a better mousetrap. And so if you give us time to figure it out, we're going to figure it out. Whether it is the American Army in after Kasserine Pass or the American Army in Iraq in 2004-06, or the American Army in Afghanistan in 2001. I don't have any doubt at all that our military and our society's genius for adaptation will save us, provided we have the time to adapt. Because we're not very good at having it right. We're brilliant at getting it right. And so I think my answer to your question would be, no, we probably don't have it right on thinking about what do we do to prevent a malevolent China from attacking Taiwan and attempting to collapse security in Asia and leaving the United States with the draconian choice of either fighting China or retreating from Asia. But we're actually already solving that problem, right? We're having big, loud debates about whether we have the right operational concepts for this strategy. Oh my God, do we even have the right equipment for it? Admiral Davidson was in town last week, arguing that we need to have a lot better firepower and a lot better dispersal of our assets in the Pacific. So I think we're doing actually really well. And if the Chinese were going to challenge American influence in Asia, they are making a lot of mistakes, not least of which is giving us the time to adapt.
But to that adaptation question, though, right? When America entered World War II, it was not very combat experienced, obviously. There was a lot of derision, for example, from British allies who had been there and done it. And they were like, oh, you know, you guys are just not
evergreen.
Evergreen, correct. And Kasserine Pass happened. But the thing that actually smart Brits noticed was the extraordinary speed with which we learned and actually got good and actually got better than British forces did in an But that was a very short period of time. If you look at, Corey, if you look at our performance in Iraq and in Afghanistan, it was very slow. It was very grueling. If you look at the acquisition system now, we've tried every way to short circuit it, but it won't move at the speed we need it to move, right? What do we intellectually need to be doing differently than we're doing now so that we don't satisfy ourselves that change in 5 years is fast? Because actually in 5 years, World War II was over in 3 years, 9 months. What do we need to do in how we're thinking about the problem, both on the civilian, but also on the military side, that actually 6 years isn't fast enough? We've got to be able to do some giant things in 6 months to 2 years, vice, we'll get it right in 10.
Well, I'm not sure that's true, but it's a useful standard to set. And limbering ourselves up all over the place. You know, I winced when you were giving your peroration about the United States being the best fighting force in history. Because every time I hear a Secretary of Defense say that, a little alarm bell goes off in the back of my head, because I feel like if you have to try and convince yourself of that, it's probably an indication of institutional dry rot, right?
You're probably like, not as good as you think you are if you keep saying that to yourself.
Exactly. I mean, maybe it's, a good hitter psyching himself up to take a curveball. But I think it's unhealthy for institutions to do that. And the reason I think it is because every good strategist is fundamentally a desperate paranoiac, right? Because if you don't spend all of your time thinking about what could go wrong, right? A trap door is going to open underneath my chair and I'm going to fall into the sewer underneath the street. How do I prevent that happening? Good strategists are paranoiacs. They're people who are always worried about what's going wrong and are exquisitely attuned to perceive small changes in their environment and to reflect on what can I be doing differently and better to advantage what I'm trying to accomplish. So complacency, I think, is our enemy. And we are, I think in Asia, we are now waking up to the dangers of our complacency. I don't think we are complacent about the challenge of a China that is domestically repressive and internationally aggressive. I think there's a lot of interesting thought going into that right now. And I am confident that if we had to face a serious challenge from China on your timeline of 6 months from now, I would want to take the intellectual effort that Americans are putting into that over whatever the Chinese are putting into it. Because if you think we're complacent and think we're awesome, dial into the Chinese dialogue on this, because they seem to have an arrogance problem in addition to a complacency problem that I God, think would bode ill for them.
God willing, they keep it up, right? I mean, if your adversary is making a mistake, exactly don't correct them. Don't correct them,
exactly.
Corey.
You know, Grant writes in his memoir, critical of Edwin Stanton, the Secretary of War, and he says, Stanton could see all of our deficiencies, but he could not see the enemy was failing. And I a little bit hear that in my mind when we're talking about the stampeding rise of China. It's not at all clear that's how this plays.
We're going to go into a lightning round because we've got you for about another 5 minutes, and I've got a bunch of questions, and I want you to take a bite at each of them very briefly.
Okay.
Are we over-militarizing the China debate? And is this actually more civilian thinking needed on the diplomatic, economic, national, technological, right? We have a tendency of seeing China through the defense lens. Do we need to be thinking this as much more of an integrated civilian strategy, which is, I think, where Jake Sullivan and the administration is trying to take it, but I want to get your sense.
Yes and yes. So Jim Mattis and I have been having a running gun fight about this very subject, where I think the Trump administration over-militarized the problem of China. And Jim rightly counters that the military was just the fastest out of the blocks to do their part of it. And so it looks over-militarized, to which I counter, it looks over-militarized because it was. Right? If the Pentagon is way out in front of the other pieces of the execution of the strategy, that is over-militarizing. And I agree with you that the Biden administration is trying to pull the other elements forward. And that's a very good thing because it actually benefits China to allow this to be narrowly channeled into a military conversation, because their military task is actually much easier than our military task of holding allies together, defending across the Pacific, preventing Taiwan from being attacked, right? Like, our challenges are objectively more difficult. And so the broader we widen the aperture to force the Chinese leadership to have to think about other problems and take other elements and other consequences and costs into account, the better it will be for what we're trying to do.
Let me ask you, I've got three questions. One is example of good strategy and bad strategy. And I'm going to end with asking you, what do you ultimately, what do you think President Biden should do? Give me an example of great strategy from your standpoint worth emulating and bad strategy that should serve as a cautionary tale. We ask all of our guests this question.
Sure. Good strategy is Bill Veeck sending a midget up to bat when he needed somebody on base in a playoff game. Right? There was no rule against it. It was an outrage once he did it, but there was no rule against it. And the strike zone of somebody 4 feet tall is objectively extraordinarily difficult to hit. So that's an example of great strategy. And I wish more American strategists read Bill Veeck's Hustler's Handbook than read, Alfred Thayer Mahan. An example of bad strategy. The Japanese attacking Pearl Harbor for whatever of their complicated reasons, declaring war on the United States was, as Admiral Yamamoto anticipated, but didn't get to make the political choice, was going to be the end of Japanese dominance of Asia. They were thinking too short term. The Japanese Imperial Japan was thinking too short term and didn't know enough about their potential adversary, and in particular, its industrial and agricultural might.
I should point out for all of those people who do not understand what Corey is talking about from a baseball standpoint, you're talking about Eddie Gaedel, who was the shortest major league ball player at 3'7" and was with the St. Louis Browns at the time. And the famous game you're talking about was in August 1951.
I just googled that.
My statistical and my repertoire of absurd facts, I knew about the incident. I did not know the mechanics, so full disclosure, I did have to tap away on the Google.
Good for you.
Very skilled. Let me ask you one last question. The president of the United States, civil military relations does ultimately hinge on the relationship that the president strikes and sets. Successful presidents exert civilian control over the military, whether it's Abraham Lincoln or Franklin Roosevelt at the end of the day. And there's this concern that those who haven't been successful, like Lyndon Johnson, for example, lack sort of a clear vision. And everybody comes back to the story of Dr. Elliot Cohen, who's also been a guest on this show, of Johns Hopkins SAIS, who at the time was working for the Bush administration and told the president, look, you can either serve, be a cheerleader or a president in 2006. And it drove President Bush to take the drastic actions required to turn the Iraq war around. We got a new defense secretary, a new chairman, a new head of operations. Dave Petraeus took over and executed a strategy that was built by the likes of Jim Mattis and H.R. McMaster and Frank Hoffman and Fred from AEI, among others, who actively worked that. What do you think President Biden has to do now to ensure that civil military relations stay on a good footing at the end of the day and improve the relationship? And what are some strategic issues that you think he and his team have got to keep tracking?
It's an interesting question, to which I confess I don't have a good answer, because I think civil military relations are robust and sound in the United States. I haven't actually spent much time thinking about what the president and the new administration need to do differently to sustain them, because I actually think they're in good shape and pretty robust. But couple of things they shouldn't do. They shouldn't be so focused on issues of social and political concern that they lose sight that we have a military for a particular purpose. And that purpose is protecting and advancing American interests by force if necessary. And I a little bit worried that they don't have the balance of messaging quite right to remind people, in particular, to remind civilians beyond the Beltway why we do this in the first place, because that goes to keeping a strong basis of support for defense spending. A second thing they really shouldn't do that and is but not only bad for the country, but bad for civil-military relations, is to pretend that they are adequately resourcing the strategy if they are not. The Mackenzie Eaglin tells me that the OMB passback include for the FY22 budget includes a real 3% reduction in defense spending. And I seem to recall when the National Defense Strategy came into play, the Secretary of Defense said it would take 3 to 5% real increase in spending year on year in order to execute that strategy. And if that's true, then we have bought an enormous amount of risk of failing to be able to carry out our strategy. And so I think honesty and transparency about where we are accruing risk based on how we resource defense and other elements of our strategy, that's something that creates an enormous amount of civil military friction. If the politicians don't want to take responsibility for the choices that they're actually making, and I think we saw some of that tension in the Obama administration. And it's not healthy. So those would be two things I would suggest.
Corey, it's always an honor and pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for being so generous with your time. Enjoyed the discussion very much and already looking back to welcoming you on again. Thanks so very much.
It was fun, my friend.